This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, November 17th, 2020, on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ahead this hour, we'll introduce you to the new podcast, Reflections, hosted by two very familiar voices, Antoinette Grajeda and Leah Uribe. The podcast explores how music and arts can be an agent for healing and social change. The first episode is our second half hour this Tuesday. Arkansas's active cases and hospitalizations connected to COVID-19 are at a pandemic high, and the Arkansas Department of Health reported a new single reporting day high in virus deaths Monday. There were 38 confirmed coronavirus deaths reported Monday, another 4 probable deaths. There are now 861 Arkansans in hospitals because of the virus. That's a 24-hour increase of 31 hospitalizations. The state's number of active cases, 16,485. Monday's new total of confirmed and probable cases totaled just more than 1,300. Governor Asa Hutchinson noted in a tweet on Monday that this week's early week numbers are higher than last week's, and he thinks the state could be in for, quote, a tough week. Northwest Arkansas hospitals are reporting there are 79 patients in COVID-19 units. That's an increase of 3 since Friday. The National Weather Service expects clear conditions tonight. Lows should be around 40 throughout the region, mostly sunny tomorrow, highs between 67 and 70. And Arkansas's opening match in the SEC soccer tournament is taking place tonight. Arkansas, the regular season champs and the number one seed in the tournament, playing Auburn tonight in the quarterfinals. Arkansas received byes through the first two rounds. The winner of tonight's match in Orange Beach, Alabama, advances to Thursday night's 6 p.m. semifinal match. This is Ozarks at Large. Since school resumed in late August across Arkansas, we've been hearing from educators, parents, and students throughout our region. We're checking in with two of those teachers to see how their year is going, since both of them returned to the classroom nearly 3 months ago.
Well, teaching this year has for sure been unlike any other year.
Annabelle Yu is a French teacher at Fayetteville High School.
This is my 20th year at the high school. So I have a few under my belt, and man, I mean, it's one unexpected thing after the next.
She says this school year has been a lot of things all at once. Better, worse, more challenging, more fulfilling, more tiring. And in at least one way, it's been surprising.
I mean, this is tricky for me to say because I don't want to give anybody the wrong idea. But as far as like positive cases and number of students quarantined, I am very surprised at how low that number has been because, you know, I mean, people were saying we're not even going to make it until Labor Day.
Personally, Bill Yu believes the numbers are still too high, but it appears safety measures like mask wearing and social distancing that have been put in place in Fayetteville schools are working.
My experience is that the students have been very compliant. You know, I mean, nobody wants to wear a mask all day. Let's be honest. It's not easy. And the students don't get a whole lot of break from wearing a mask. But they are compliant.
She says students seem to understand the severity of the situation. And for the most part, the precautions are not getting in the way of the main thing they're all there to do.
What I have been encouraged by is that learning is happening. And so that's been really nice because as an educator, that's your ultimate reward.
But Bill Yu adds, she has noticed more students than usual are underperforming or checking out altogether.
So that's disappointing. And I think that's a struggle and a frustration for everyone involved, students, parents, teachers, and administrators. And so we just haven't quite, you know, solved that puzzle.
And then there's the workload.
The workload has been soul-crushing, to be honest with you. Professionally speaking, it's been a very difficult year
Beaulieu says that's mostly because she has to take the lessons she teaches in person in three different classes and make them suitable for students who are learning virtually.
And that takes a long time. It's not as simple as just drag and drop. There's so much that I cannot even use from my 20 years that I have. My bag of tricks might as well be empty because not many of them are really very useful this year because, like we've said, it's a whole different approach.
Aside from the additional labor that goes into creating virtual content, Beaulieu says she also has to make sure all her students are getting an equitable education, whether they're learning in person, online, or in a hybrid format.
You have to be careful what you're doing with your on-site students so that it's not so vastly different from what your online students are getting, because ultimately they all have to end up at the same spot.
Although she teaches much younger students, Rosanna Brown's school year bears a lot of similarities to Beaulieu's.
Well, it is more time consuming than I expected.
Brown is a fourth grade teacher at Ballman Elementary School in Fort Smith.
Aside from all the time of trying to get all your lessons blended and online and available to students who are not there, then you have to go back and you still have all the grading and planning that you had before, but you're also at the same time converting everything. And so it is a lot more time consuming.
Despite all that, Brown says she's thrilled to be back to teaching in person.
I love to see the aha moments when they tell me, hey, I'm stuck on this. I like to go, okay, let's start from the very beginning so I can see where you're stuck. And I like that step-by-step process. I like trying to meet them where they're at.
Brown has about 17 students in her classroom, when normally she says she'd have nearly 30. And while her students are 9 and 10 years old, they've been diligent about wearing their masks and following other safety guidelines.
I do highly encourage my little learners to let me know. And they can always go out in the hall where I put big red X's 6 feet apart. If no one else is in the hall, they can go out there. We do have painted big X's in the playground with bright orange paint, and we go out there for mask breaks.
When her students do leave the classroom for lunch, Brown says they all have assigned seats at the cafeteria.
We have extra lunch periods, and they're spread out from, they start at 10:30 and end at like almost 1. And so we could spread the kids out. There's only those big long tables. I think we have 3 on one side and 3 on the other, so that they are spread out. And the chairs are numbered for the big kids, so they know what number chair is theirs, and another piece of tape for names for the little kids.
The Fort Smith School District has also started making its own disinfectant and hired extra staff to help sanitize the buildings and playground throughout the day.
So it is working out really well. We recently were allowed, with this new hiring of sanitation, to use playground equipment. And so we have to make sure they sanitize their hands before they go outside, and then they have to sanitize their hands when they come back inside. And so there's a lot of sanitizer being used.
Brown says she encourages parents to keep their children home if there's any indication they might be sick or could have been exposed to COVID-19, which is why she converts all of her in-person learning plans to an online format. Brown hasn't had any cases in her classroom so far, and she is notified of instances of the virus in her building via email. But because of privacy concerns, all other information is left out.
There was a class close to mine, and somebody did test positive, one of the students, and they quarantined half the class and the teacher. Nobody else had a positive test, and they all came back. But it was really... I thought it was handled really well. It was very swift, very quick. The minute they found out, everybody was immediately notified and sent home.
In Fayetteville, the school district has launched a COVID-19 dashboard that's updated every day at 5 p.m. It includes information about cases and possible exposures among students and staff. It also lists schools with 5 or more active or quarantined cases. As an educator, Anna Beaulieu says it's important to have access to as much of that information as possible.
those numbers mean something, you know, and those numbers are going to, that's information that people need to be able to evaluate their own situation to decide what's best for, you know, themselves personally, but also their families moving forward. So I do applaud the district for doing that.
But she says Fayetteville and other school districts around the state could benefit from more manpower for monitoring and controlling the spread of the virus.
One of the things is there's always so many things going on and there's so many questions and there's so many things to do that's really easy for information to get lost. And it's really easy to just let a question go that you did want the answer to, but something else has taken precedence.
And while Beliu believes there are things the district could be doing better, administrators have made improvements along the way, like increasing signage and implementing temperature checks for staff and students. She also says she feels relatively safe with the precautions she's able to take in her classroom.
I am able to distance students at 6 feet. And I have, you know, I have a little barrier for myself at the front of the room, more for me because I'm a walker.
As the president of the Fayetteville Education Association, which is a district-wide teachers union, Beliu also regularly communicates with other educators.
You know, it depends on the teacher, depends on the content, but for a lot of us, our home virtual students are suffering. You know, I mean, they're not participating at the same rate as their on-site counterparts. And to be honest with you, students don't know how to learn like this. And it's not their fault. And it's not our fault either. We've never had to teach this way. So they've never had to learn this way.
Which is why Beliu says, now more than ever, she wants to remind the community the education system is a partnership. And that partnership should include a consideration of the way people choose to spend the next few holidays.
We've done a good job so far. But I think that is because everybody has been very compliant with the safety protocols and many of the parents have been very good about keeping strict regulations on the, you know, themselves and their families when they're home. As soon as we start to relax that, then that's going to impact everyone. And then we may end up in a situation where we don't have a choice and school has to shut down and go virtual.
Beliu also encourages community members to pay attention to the education-related bills that come before the state legislature in the coming legislative session, and to consider whether the state should go ahead with teacher evaluations and standardized testing during this school year. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zuzana Sitek.
This is your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the Ozarks at Large podcast in case you missed our over-the-air broadcast. You can subscribe for free through any of the major podcast distributors.
KUAF is supported by Pack Rat Outdoor Center, Northwest Arkansas's outdoor outfitter since 1973. Pack Rat offers work to wilderness clothing, footwear, and more. Information including outdoor clinics and events available on Facebook or PackRatOC.com. The Arkansas Natural Sky Association reminds everyone that light pollution is not just about losing sight of the stars. Light pollution wastes energy and impacts wildlife, climate, and human health. More information regarding where and how to protect, preserve, and enjoy natural state skies is available online at DarkSkyArkansas.org. It's time for the annual KUAF and Friends Holiday Giveaway. It's your chance to win a gift from KUAF and one of many generous KUAF underwriters. Participants include Mockingbird Kitchen, Center Street Mercantile, the Museum of Native American History, and more. Winners announced Friday, December 11th during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Details and registration available at KUAF.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. Each fall, the Scholars at Risk Committee at the University of Arkansas hosts a lecture to further place emphasis on the dangers to academic thought and freedom around the world. This year's Professor Dick Bennett Lecture will be conducted online and will feature Bakhtabek Bashimov, a faculty member at the Global Studies and International Relations Program at Northeastern University. A one-time diplomat from Kyrgyzstan to India, Nepal, Sri Lanka, and Bangladesh, Bashmov had to flee his native country after threats to his life by the government there. His speech, which will be delivered on Zoom tomorrow evening at 5, is titled Post-Soviet Central Asia: New Authoritarianism and Academic Freedom. He says he knows many Americans might not know much about Central Asia, but there are universal themes in his address.
But what is important for Americans is to understand that we are on a daily basis between two choices, between liberty and authority. And it is happening and going on in Central Asia, in all post-Soviet countries, and it's going on in the United States. That's why if we, for instance, sacrifice our liberty for the interests of authority, you can just imagine the outcome of this. That's why through the principles of academic freedom, I would like to explain how it's important to support those who are trying to question things, who would like just a critical look at everything, who would like to see reality in its different manifestations, and support diversity of opinions.
He says there are many places where academic expression and research continue to be highly dangerous fields.
Soviet Union has ceased to exist, but the dogmatic mindset reinvented itself in new forms of existence there. And secondly, these countries today under the rule of autocratic leaders who prefer their version of reality. And academics who, by their profession and training and mind, they like to question things that cannot be framed by these ideologies or these rulers. And that's why it's dangerous for them.
Bashmov's native Kyrgyzstan has been embroiled in post-election confusion and chaos this fall. His adopted home, the United States, is in the middle of some post-election tumult of its own. He says it's important for people to not take freedoms for granted.
People should understand that freedom should be supported by them. And only through this support, freedom can exist everywhere, in academia, in our society. That's why I am lucky one who are experiencing these days, and I am trying to understand what's going on and how we can contribute to the support of democracy in the United States. Of course, in my upcoming lecture, I will share with my colleagues how I see the situation in the United States with regard to academic freedom and how academic freedom affected by the political turmoil in this country.
Bakhtibek Bashmov will deliver the 2020 Professor Dick Bennett Lecture as a guest of the Scholars at Risk Committee at the University of Arkansas. The lecture is tomorrow evening at 5 via Zoom. The lecture is free and open to the public. You can find a link at OzarksAtLarge.com. This is Ozarks at Large. Today, we're introducing you to a new podcast featuring the talents of two familiar voices to Ozarks at Large listeners, Antoinette Grajeda and Leah Uribe. Here is the debut episode of Reflections.
Hello, and welcome to Reflections. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I am Leah Uribe.
This is our first episode. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. And since this is the premiere episode, we want to tell you a little bit about our project. And since this was actually Leah's idea, I'm going to let her take it over and explain it to you.
Well, thank you so much, Antoinette. I am super excited to share with a bigger audience these thoughts that have been in my mind for such a long time. Reflections started as a grant proposal for an opportunity at the University of Arkansas. But since and after the interaction between local artists, the team, Reflections team, and our community of audiences and people around, it's growing into something more interesting than just the grant. We're here with a mission because we believe that music has the power to change social dynamics and to affect social dynamics. So we have been exploring ways to bring that message to our students, our community at the university, our Northwest Arkansas community, and, you know, affect them by the power of the arts. So Reflections is a series in which we bring artists to talk to us, to teach us, to connect with the community. We choose those artists because they are not only amazing in their art and in their craft, but also because they have found this way to connect with the communities and to represent them and to disrupt them and to, you know, create some sort of movement that has been proven to, you know, affect and create reflection and to change dynamics. So that's basically what we're doing with Reflections series. It's a teamwork. It was an idea that I had for the longest time that has been transformed over the years. But it's eight of us from different disciplines. Some of us are musicians. Some of us work in radio, like you, Antoinette. Some of us are with the College of Business and are very interested in entrepreneurship. Some of us are in the world languages, world territory, with representing, you know, other languages and other cultures. So we just, you know, with all of this energy and passion, got together to foster this idea and to give it shape. And here we are with our first episode of a conversation that in fact is bringing some amazing people to show us and to allow us to, like in a good reflection, see ourselves in what they have done and give us inspiration.
That's Camille Zamora. She's co-founder of Sing for Hope, along with fellow soprano Monica Eunice, and we're so pleased to have them as our inaugural guests for the Reflections music series. As part of their virtual residency, they spoke with us about their careers and how their nonprofit unites artists and communities. Camille says Sing for Hope uses the power of the arts to create a better world.
Sing for Hope, as we often say, we're an arts Peace Corps. We are a group of artists who want to use the arts to drive social deliverables, to drive social cohesion and healing and learning and uplift for individuals and communities. And I would argue that most people in the arts identify that way, that we're drawn to the arts, yes, because we love making loud noises in the case of opera singers, but also because we believe in that truth and that light that the arts can convey. So yeah, I mean, I think Monica and I weren't unique in that we were very much compelled by that kind of work. I think in our sort of family of origin lives, Monica had grown up around that, and that her mother was a social worker and her father won the Nobel Peace Prize for microfinance and kind of was, you know, very much social change was in her household growing up. In my household, my parents were teachers and they had been in the Peace Corps, and they were very much about kind of looking at systems and asking questions. And I think that was sort of always in the back of my head. And frankly, one of the questions I had, I think, the more I developed my singing, was how does singing, which can feel very kind of ornamental and sort of to the side of social change, not part of it, well, how does that factor in? In my life, a very sort of intense emotional thing happened that kind of derailed my course, which was that my dear best friend from high school was diagnosed with AIDS and passed at an AIDS hospice in Houston. We were all of 24 years old, and he just, it took him down very, very quickly and left me really with a lot of questions about what I'm doing as a singer. And so I brought together a group of friends. We did a small fundraising concert, which over time grew into this really wonderful annual event in Houston. And I think it made me realize that the arts really do have a role in times of crisis, in times of emotional pain for communities, not just for individuals, but as a way to bind a community that needs to come together in, I would sort of say, almost a spiritual way, not a religious way and not sort of a sectarian way, but in a way that feels profound and deep to acknowledge loss. And that was something that I did every year. And then Monica and I were at Juilliard on September 11th, not too many people know this about Juilliard, but it shares a city block with a firehouse, and they were among the first responders that day. And so in the days after, we gathered some friends and we went to that firehouse and knocked on the door and sang for the firemen that were still there, who at the time were still waiting for people, for their brothers to come back. And of course, we know that wasn't going to happen. But on that day, we gathered, we sang, and we knew, we really had this shared moment that this was something that we really wanted to do more of. How was it that we could take what we were learning in our practice rooms and apply it to health, healing, and what was that structure like, and how could we do that? And the more questions we had, the less answers we had. And so we just kept asking a lot of questions at that time. We were two sopranos, so that means characteristically sort of driven and ambitious. So it wasn't that we didn't want to be on stage. We wanted that too. But we also knew that there was something that there was some application that we really needed to figure out. And so that really catalyzed a journey between the two of us of how we were going to figure that out together.
And in the years since, how have you figured that out? What are some of the key...
I'm trying to figure it out. That's the beauty of nonprofit, is that it's an endless journey.
It is an endless journey. But where we are right now in this moment, that some of the things that you have figured out in terms of delivering arts to people, you have some key programs. Could you tell us a little bit about those?
What Sing for Hope is today looks very different than what we initially launched, but that was the key, was we did launch. And what we started off doing were just, you know, little fundraising concerts for causes that spoke to our hearts. Over time, we started saying, you know what, we're delivering these small pots of funding to nonprofits. What if we deliver this other currency, art? What if we just directly deliver music to these facilities? What if we directly deliver visual arts to these healthcare institutions? What if we just really go in and get involved and roll up our sleeves? And I think for us, the through line has always been the belief that art creates a better world, the belief that we all benefit when we tear down these barriers to accessibility, and also the belief that it's not about coming to meet us on our turf and our terms. Obviously, we love deeply these arts institutions that we are lucky enough to work for, you know, Lincoln Center and Carnegie Hall, these wonderful institutions that are bricks and mortar, that are physical locations. We love those and we need those in society. But we also need moments that go directly into people's homes and I think blur those barriers. And so in our case, we started going to schools, we started going to hospitals, and in 2010, we started putting artist-designed pianos in the streets of New York City. The Sing for Hope pianos now are New York City's largest public art project. They happen every year, on pause this year, of course, because of COVID, but they are basically a tangible, playable symbol of what we believe in, which is art for all, that everybody has that creative spark inside of themselves, and that given wonderful tools, like a piano, especially an artist-designed piano, that we are inspired to unlock that creative spark, and that has massive, massive benefits for social cohesion and for individual well-being.
One of the benefits or outcomes that I've seen of your work is this connectivity between people. With the pianos especially, if you think just on a basic level that you're walking down the street and you see this beautiful piano that's colorful and someone's playing it, you stop and you listen, you stop, maybe you have a conversation that you wouldn't otherwise. Well, as you mentioned, that's on hold because of the pandemic. So how do you continue trying to have that connectivity when people need it maybe more than ever?
The beautiful thing and the very unexpected thing is that it has, you know, this time has provided some opportunities. And when I say that, I mean that, you know, yes, Sing for Hope had been delivering everything in person. And we had been thinking about how could we do things in different ways. But I think it took this moment to stop us in our tracks and say, okay, we have to continue. We have to put one foot in front of the other, just like everyone else, and figure out ways in which we can still
be true to our mission. One of the things that we came up with very quickly was something that we call Sing for Hope Grams. And so it's an old-timey singing telegram delivered via Zoom or delivered via your phone, you know, within our Healing Arts program that, again, used to be live artist coming to a patient's room. We have developed, a video series, and it's live. That is live too. So just like we're talking here right now, and just a little while, actually, from this moment, we have an incredible, probably the most famous jazz violinist, Regina Carter, is going to be doing a concert for some of the patients that in one of our elder care facilities. And with our schools program, you know, we have things in the works to do teacher trainings. Accessing students right now is difficult. And that's the thing, you know, I think that every organization, nonprofit, for-profit, and everything in between will come to a moment where you have to figure out, how do I move beyond this? And that is, in my humble opinion, that is the job and the role of an artist within society, is to figure out, how do I get around this? How do I translate this feeling that I have, that I know other humans are experiencing, grief, loss, joy, and every shade on the emotional spectrum? How do I bring that out? And how do I allow them to figure out ways to see somebody whose shoes I've never walked in? What is that like? How do I take that on?
Sing for Hope started with singing for the firefighters on 9/11, and now your programs continue during another crisis of the pandemic. You mentioned the singing to patients in hospitals. What kind of power do the arts have to help in the process of healing?
Part of the exciting thing, and also in some ways the frustrating thing of this moment of the arts, in particular the arts business, is that indeed we are, I would say, just at the starting point of really tracking the metrics. So many people have spoken so beautifully about this. Yo-Yo Ma, Darren Walker, the president of the Ford Foundation. I love what Darren said once in a talk that I heard him give, which is, how do you measure joy? And by that same token, I would say, how do you measure the efficacy of that feeling of inspiration that a great song can make us feel in our heart, that feeling of freedom that we can have in our limbs when we watch someone move, when we ourselves start to move and dance? How do you measure that? And then, even more complex, how do you take that measurement and align it with a healing metric? All of that is very complex work. That said, happily, I do think science is starting to catch up with what we all know in our bones. You know, frankly, even the fact that I use that phrase, you know, in our bones, we sense things in physical ways. I'll just give you one example. We all know that if I was on this call right now and I start to yawn, probably in the back of your throat, some part of you would want to yawn. Why is that? Because mirror neurons, our bodies do talk to each other on a cellular level. And all sorts of stuff happens in what I would call the subtextual level of any conversation. The beautiful thing about music, and the reason why a great song can make tears spring to our eyes, is it speaks cell to cell. Something profound happens. Now, how you measure that, and then how you communicate that, and frankly, how you fund it on a very broad, broad scale, that is the task of our lifetimes. It's something that I hope that we will fast track, because it needs broad scale public and private funding. But I think people are ready for this message. And I think right now, as we, you know, we look at the profound vulnerabilities of our healthcare system, we are also looking seriously at ways that we can fast track efficacy. And music and the arts absolutely fast tracks healing. We know it.
Beautiful dream. To me, sunlight and dewdrops are waiting for thee. Songs of the rude world heard in the day, lulled by the moonlight, have all passed away.
Your dad is from Bangladesh, Monica. You spent some time in Mexico City, Camille. How does have informed your musical decisions, having been exposed to those cultures and having that in your blood and in your life?
I am definitely a product of my musical environment, and I feel like that is a lifetime of exploration, just in the sense that there's so much music in the world. I grew up very strongly associated with my mother's roots, which were Russian, and so I grew up singing in the Russian Orthodox Church choir with my grandmother, and that music as you know, 4, 5, 6 year old and on is very much a part of my neuron makeup. And then I've had obviously the fortune of going to my birth country of Bangladesh and have not spent as much time as I would have liked, frankly, in immersing myself into a whole nother world. And in fact, today I was thinking about this, that, you know, in all of my education, I think there wouldn't be enough time to explore all of it because there are so many different worlds of music to explore. And my conservatory training really focused on very much a, you know, European classical certain canon training. You know, I take it upon myself to have to explore this other incredibly rich tradition that is part of, as you said, my blood, my makeup. I've also been very fortunate to travel as a singer. I think that's one of the things that I treasure most about being a singer is that I have visited parts of the world that I think if had I not been a singer, I would never have had that opportunity. I hold very dear to my heart that I was an ambassador for a festival in Beirut, Lebanon, called the Zouk Mikhail International Festival. And of course, you know, today we sit here and we know what's just happened there. It's tragic. I've been so lucky, I feel, to have gone to the Paris of the Middle East and to have met incredible people there that I still very much keep in touch with and luckily are still okay. And I've had that relationship for several years now. And so being able to go to different parts of the world and explore and exchange, you know, this musical languages is really something that I feel very fortunate to have had the opportunity to do.
We're all made up of you know, many different sort of genetic aspects, obviously, but I always joke that the part of me that sings is my Spanish heritage. For whatever reason, that was always just what resonated with me. My father was from a Spanish Basque family and was the first person in his family to go to college, went on to make an amazing career as a legal scholar, and actually he was the first Hispanic dean of a law school in Texas and founded the Center for U.S. and Mexican Law. So I spent a lot of my childhood going back and forth between Houston and Mexico City, as I mentioned, and just somehow that music always just, there was something about sort of Spanish idiom that just felt so singable to me. And part of it was the music that I heard from him. But I think it was just something, you know, very deep and kind of resonant in me that just always made sense. So I, you know, I'm very grateful for that. You know, at the same time, I think there's something so, you know, powerful. And I think it's part of the reason why music works so well in educational settings is that there is something, of course, very universal. I often think there are three things that really allow us the fast understanding of another culture. It's music, sport, and food. So I think, you know, that's been, for me, part of the joy, I think, in training academically as well as a musician has been that in that sort of cool scholarly ways, I've been able to fall down all sorts of wonderful rabbit holes in terms of undiscovered Spanish repertoire. I mean, needless to say, there are boundless treasures still to be unearthed really in every category. But I think it's a particularly interesting moment for us in this country, in the United States, to look at certain expressions that haven't necessarily been the majority culture expression in the concert hall.
You mentioned there being a specific type of white European music that is seen in the concert halls typically. And I think Camille in the past, I've actually heard you say it's very much a white supremacist space. And I would love to hear you talk a little bit more about that in terms of, you know, what you mean by that. And is it something that should change and how do we change that?
I want to begin by just saying a few words about, you know, even the phrase white supremacy, because I do think, you know, this is such a moment for us to be intentional. And I would also argue for us to be loving with language. The phrase white supremacy is an incendiary phrase. And I will begin by saying that, for example, if I were to bring that into a conversation with people of my parents' generation, that would possibly be a conversation stopper. Because the phrase white supremacy would be heard as neo-Nazi. It would be heard as actively hate-filled. And there is definitely a strain of that, clearly. But when I use the phrase white supremacy in this context and as part of the classical music dialogue right now, for me, it's not so much about wanting to talk about the hateful neo-Nazi, you know, actively racist aspect of that. What I'm interested in talking about is the default setting systems. I would argue, and I don't think it is a very controversial point, to say that if you look at the classical music landscape, we see a default setting that is largely white, vastly largely white, and that is driven by multiple factors. It is driven, you know, I think a really key point is it's driven by our educational systems. And that's why it's an exciting opportunity to speak with you all in an amazing leading educational institution about what that means. And I think it is something that we have to reckon with. We have to discuss it. When we look at the majority of our classical music audiences, when we look at the majority of, you know, so many classical music collaborations, we do see a majority of white participants. And what does that mean? Is that intentional? I would say many cases, no. But I think we have to be very intentional in our analysis of it if we want to see the world as we hold it in our hearts. If we really want to build towards that reality, we have to be very analytical. We have to look at, you know, what is it about these systems that have not optimized people of color for participants, for programmatic reasons, for, you know, where are our women composers in the concert hall? Where are our people of color when it comes to the podium, when it comes to our orchestral players, when it comes to so many of our audience members? And I think being analytical about that, listen, I mean, if you even just look at it in sheer market terms, if you look at it in sheer efficacy of product to consumer, the simple fact is it has been proven that diverse teams make effective teams. It has been proven that we can better deliver value if we are more representing our culture at large. I am always aware of the fact that it is very hard to have these conversations. I would be the first to say that I often make mistakes. It is very tricky to even kind of open this what can feel like a minefield for discussion. But I would argue that unless we are bold about having these conversations, and in particular having these conversations in universities and in conservatories, if we can embolden ourselves to take a deep breath, to know that we're probably going to make mistakes, but that if we do it mindfully and if we really listen to each other, I really do think this is such a profound moment to make positive change. And frankly, if we don't, classical music will have less and less and less relevance with every passing season. We simply must look at where we come from and where we want to go.
Have you ever felt unwelcome in the classical music sphere?
Yes. Yes. I mean, the simple answer is yes. You know, I can't speak for other people, but for myself, I can say that I have absolutely gone through that. And I don't think that that is unique. And I think, you know, my training, my personality has made me say, okay, I'm going to put on my rhinoceros skin today. Beverly Johnson used to say, you know, the artist has to have the skin of a rhinoceros, but the soul of a butterfly. And so I would put on my rhinoceros skin and go on. But, you know, I'm thrilled that there are conversations happening where, you know, I don't have to sit in a makeup chair and have basically whitening makeup put on me to look more like a character in an opera. And that has happened to me. And that's not the way forward.
You know, I am the white passing daughter of a Spanish father and a Norwegian mom. And I do feel that if anything, I have often reaped the benefits of a majority culture perspective. I could go down all sorts of anecdotal stories this way and that way, but I do want to say I am constantly shocked and heartbroken by the stories, in particular from my Black friends and colleagues, of just sort of the unbelievable things that they have experienced, whether it is the, you know, being offered a job on the spot for singing 10 times as well as any other baritone. And then said baritone, my dear friend, goes to a party a couple of months later, wondering why he didn't get the contract, which had been offered to him on the spot, and then hearing, oh, you know, so sorry, you'll understand, but our board just, when we really drilled down, our board just wasn't ready for a black Marcello, you know, this sort of thing. And you know, again, you think, oh, well, that's, you know, that's not surprising for a story out of the 1940s. Oh, no. No, this was within the last year or two. So, you know, this still goes on. We have to reckon with it. We have to talk about it. We have to work together. It's not the world that we want to see. We are building towards the world we want to see. And, you know, I do think fundamentally, the reason, again, we're drawn to the arts because we're drawn to truth and light. I would also say there is an archetypal power, a sort of shaman power in what we do. And, you know, I think that is why all of these hundreds of years later, so much of this music still does mean so much to us, is because it stirs up the most primal parts of who we are. And with that stuff stirred up, you can do all kinds of things. You can rebuild society. You know, so I don't think it's about needing to throw away the canon. I do think Beethoven was a freedom fighter in his way. Mozart was a profound guy of the people. There is a reason why this music still speaks to us and still has profound use. And it is because, you know, I would even say opera in particular, it is the realm of the archetype. Death, truth, light, love, loss, grief, all of this big, big stuff, music is big enough to encompass it. But the delivery systems haven't been equitable. And we have to look at that and we have to redress it. And it's an incredibly exciting moment to do this. Everyone is ready. That's what I'm going to say. Everyone is ready.
And everyone's invited.
Our guests today were Monica Yunus and Camille Zamora. They are co-founders of Sing for Hope. And Leah, they gave us a lot to think about today. Is there one reflection for you from what we heard?
Many reflections, and I just wanted to say that when choosing the title for this, what I like to call a movement, I look into the many definitions of what reflection is, from the idea of propagating sound, right, which is what they do when they sing or hire other musicians and artists to sing for communities, express reverse dynamics like mirrors do, and that's what we're doing, reversing those dynamics, and that's what they do of those Eurocentric music and composers. Reflection also as a careful consideration, and I think all of this conversation really has brought a lot of very important subjects for us to continue thinking about, specifically in this context of music, and even more so in classical music. How do we use this world that has been presented to us for so long, and how can we reverse those dynamics and be proactive and be more inclusive and reach out to many, many more people? Because as you and I have conversations before, the world of music and classical music is beautiful as is, but it would be much richer and much better when many more voices are there represented. And that's something that Monica and Camille also touch on in our conversation.
If you would like to share your own reflection from this conversation with us, please send an email to reflections, that's R-E-F-L-E-X-I-O-N-S, musicseries@gmail.com, and we may share your thoughts in an upcoming episode. As Leah mentioned, creating and launching the Reflections Music Series and its many components has been a group effort. So we would like to thank our entire team, including Erica Almenada, Rogelio Garcia Contreras, Connor Gott, Liz Luscando, Rhonda Mains, Catalina Ortega, Bailey Ross, Madison Sutton, Eric Troiano, and Lee Wood. You can find out more about our project at reflectionsmusic.org. On behalf of my colleague, Leah Udibe, I'm Antoinette Brejeda. Thank you for listening, keep reflecting, and we'll see you next time.
You can find out more about podcasts available through KUAF at KUAF.com, the latest episodes of The New Classroom, about how the pandemic is affecting education in our region, and The Movement That Never Was, A People's Guide to Anti-Racism in the South and Arkansas, are there. And the second episode of The Movement That Never Was will be featured on our Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 p.m.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Single parents interested in a career in the medical field can apply to the Single Parent Scholarship Fund of NWA. Applications for certifications and allied health degrees are now open. Up to $2,000 can be earned and used towards training for dental and medical assistants, medical billing, and more. 935-4888 or Single Parent Scholarship Fund of NWA.org to apply. It's time for the annual KUAF and Friends Holiday Giveaway. It's your chance to win a gift from KUAF and one of many generous KUAF underwriters. Participants include Fayetteville Roots Festival, Downtown Springdale Alliance, Dog Party USA, and more. Winners announced Friday, December 11th during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Details and registration available at KUAF.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Gans, Oklahoma. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Timothy Dennis produced our show. Contributors this Tuesday included Susanna Saitek. Our deep appreciation to Antoinette Grajeda, Leah Uribe, and the entire Reflections team for sharing the first episode of their podcast with us. Thanks so much for listening. We will be back with you tomorrow at noon and 7 with another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large.